Okay, so alive, welcome back to the Magical Minds podcast. I'm Matt Bourke. You're watching and listening to the Liberty's number one podcast. Yup, the Liberty's, yup, the Flats, yup, the Liberty Market. On the show today, I'm joined by Carl Duquay.
Good man, man.
Yes, yup, the Flats. Fucking brilliant. I was practicing his name all day and I was totally wrong till he came in. I said, Carl, tell me your second name. Yeah. Where's the second name come from?
It's a couple of generations back, man. French. Yeah. You wouldn't be the first one to get it wrong. Anyway, I'll put it that way. I've been called a lot worse, and you get to that stage where you just let people say, pronounce it differently.
I was there, Dookie, Doochie, Douchie. Oh, it was fucking, I'll just ask. So.
Well, the mates call me Dookie.
Yeah.
And that's the short version for it, you know.
Deli, well, I'm delighted to have you on the show, brother.
Thanks, man.
Guys, I've asked Carl to come on the show. Carl works, they've collaborated with Solace Project, but originally he was with Target. Carl's going to share his background, which is, you know, difficulties growing up as a child, drink, getting himself into trouble, and now being an inspiration in his community, a team leader, helping people within the Liberty's Dublin 8, you know. And I've spoke many times on the podcast about these unsung heroes. I was only talking to Paddy Dingle today, part of the Dream of the Club, and Steve Orman, you know, all these boxing coaches. They're so important, and as I truly believe, they're unsung heroes in the communities, aren't they? Really?
Yeah.
People that do this kind of work.
Yeah, totally agree, man. And I think communities like the Liberty's, and like even relating it back to my own, like growing up in the inner city, and my family's been street traders, was like, it's a big part of like my life, of how it shaped my life today as well, you know. I loved growing up in town, loved like growing me nanny, me aunties, all street traders in Moore Street, and just going and being part of that, like hustle and bustle and madness and like all the roaring and screaming, you know. I thought that was brilliant, man.
Absolutely. I mean, I've had to starting out in a new path myself. I'm now a trader. I'm selling the Liberty Market. I never thought it'd be the case, but I absolutely love it. So look, take us back to childhood. Where did you grow up? I know you're from the north, so give us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I grew up in what I'd regard as a very strong community back then, a little flats called Henrietta Street. You know, it's only two complexes. Was a very strong sense of community where, like, even people would leave their doors open.
Is that Summer Hill?
No, Bowen Street, no Bowen Street.
Oh, College, yeah, there. Back of the School of Trades. Yeah, Bowen Street College, yeah.
And look, it was lovely, as I said, it was a very close community. A lot of family in the flats as well, you know, aunties next door and nannies across the way. And there was a great sense of, like, even community cohesion even back then, you know. I suppose even that, growing up and doing a little bit in Moore Street and going down, packing the standings in or cleaning the fruit, or, you know, for the end of the day, you're getting like 50 pence at the end of the day and you thought you were great. It was brilliant, you know. And I think, like, even for me, like, I going to school and all, like, that was, I was a messer in school, man. Like, I was really bad in school, and like what I know now, I hadn't got the supports around me back then, you know. I wasn't getting what I needed back then, and you know, I was poor out of school, and you know, it's kind of sad looking back on my life, you know, to see that even the young people I work with today, the supports they get, I hadn't got, you know. Messing, I think I was even in college, and the lecturer told me I could be a little bit dyslexic, you know. That wasn't identified and spotted back then, but again, drugs kind of come into it very early, you know. Growing up in the flats, and don't know if you know, remember like the Tipex tinners kind of bleeding hit the scene, and it's even kids dying around the city centre. No.
Yeah, we used to put Tipex tinners on our jumper and sniff it.
Yeah.
Like, we started taking acid and smoking hash in school at 12 and 14 and doing Tipex tinners and bags of glue.
Yeah. It's crazy when you look back and you know the thing. A young fella at that age, like, I would have been 10, 11, 12. There would have been a lot of older kids around and doing it. And I only hit the scene. I remember they started selling and someone copped and And even like the warnings of like people dying, and we didn't care, and I ended up getting put out of school. I ended up been going to, there was a school in Summer Hill called Hackett's, it's for like troubled kids with difficult behaviors, and I would have been put in there. And what I was put into was like older kids using more drugs, smoking hash and all, and look, me drug use just progressed, and what I even know now, even looking back on the matter, it's kind of like around your the consequences part of the frontal lobe and the brain, and it's like that wasn't formed, so I had no consequences to my action, so the progression of my drug use was kind of, it was severe, it was like by 16 years of age, like I had my mad and dad's heart broke. They didn't know what to do with me, and I remember my ma brought me to a doctor, and I was messing around with everything. I was methadone, fucking tablets, weed, the whole lot, acid, like yourself, and the doctor put me on lead methadone. At 16 years of age,
What?
the doctor put me on methadone, and to me, it was kind of like happy days, free bleeding drugs. I'm gonna get, no, I won't have to pay for it anymore. I'm gonna get it. And it's sad. It was sad looking back on it. You know what? Like, through everything I've been through and everything, I went back to that doctor, and challenged her. I went in one day and I was like, "Can I ask you why you done that? Like, why you didn't try like holistic treatments or get me a counselor?" I thought, "Not look, I probably wouldn't have changed, but the fact that I work with young people today, and there's not a hope in hell."
What was the rationale behind that?
She came at me with stats from Amsterdam from like the 70s of like the amount of like drug addicts that would relapse through. If they're not on methadone, they will relapse and kind of die. And like, I'm like, I don't live in Amsterdam. I could bring 100 people in here to you now who are off drugs and tell you their story, And it was just like, she didn't know where to look, basically,
I'm gonna guess that was early 1990, was it?
No,
80.
well, yeah, when I would have been put on.
80.
On the methadone, yeah. It
89, 88.
would have been 16, so it would have been 79, about 96, 97.
Really?
Would
How old are you?
42.
Oh, okay, cool. All right.
Yeah. Would that be right to me?
Yeah,
I
man,
was
look,
right.
we're not Carol Warden, but we got 90s anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, our rationale was like, that's what the research says, that's what statistics and
Yeah. From
the
different
stats are saying.
countries.
That's mental. I want to just go back a little bit. You were talking about your childhood and you're talking about the troubles. Just give us an insight. What kind of shit did you get yourself into? When you talk about trouble and getting yourself into trouble and getting kicked out of school, what did you do?
Yeah, well, the main reason why I threw a golf ball at the teacher, and again, even looking back, and he look at this guy, Seamus, we used to call him, he's our Irish teacher, and he didn't interact with you, he just kept writing on the blackboard, and I went to a Connell school in the North Circle Road, this Christian Brothers school, and it would have been very strict, so I was reacting to that strictness. That like if you go in and you haven't got your toy, the
Authority.
teacher would grab you up by the lock of the hair and
That was air school as well.
send you home.
Fuck. And the reason I ask this, right, and I'm not glorifying, I talk about my past and I've done stuff that's shocking and shameful, and I don't talk about it to glorify or be a Billy Big Bollocks about it, because I want to show kids that I've done stuff, and there's kids out there doing stuff that think, oh, fuck, can't believe I did that, and it's horrible, and it's good. We do them, we act out, whether it's the, because we're fearful, authority, we're fucking, there's for many, many reasons, man. That's why I asked you that. So you end up fucking a golf ball at someone?
Yeah, I end up trying and getting into fights here and there with our students as well, So, do you know what? Like, some of the teachers just used to walk into the class and say, "Duquet, out," and make me stand outside the bleeding door for the whole duration of the class,
Without saying anything.
Without saying anything, no. They just, well, obviously, from my I suppose, behaviours in the class previous, but there was no intervention or understanding or empathy towards me. It was like, you're quite outside the door, you know? So that was their way of, I suppose, dealing with it back then as well, you know? So, and obviously, like, I could have been reacting to what was ever going on in my life at the time as well, you know, my own situations going on in my life, you know?
Yeah, and we won't know, right? Growing up in the inner city, you're dealing with generational pain, grandparents passing on pain to parents, they hand it on to us. And again, all the work that I do in these podcasts, well, I never look for blame. Yeah. It just is. You know, I'm hoping to inspire, I'm hoping to, through this work, that we can break the chains of generational pain, and blame most certainly does it. But they, my ma had a hard, my grandparents had a hard, and then we got a hard, and there's no getting away from that. Growing up in the inner city was hard, even South County Dublin. I'm not saying just in our city, it's not prevalent just to us. Sometimes life is hard, and parents and grandparents hand it down. So in our city life was tough, wasn't it?
Yeah. And even looking back in it, like, me ma and dad, they done their best, like, they were grafters.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? My ma was out on Moore Street, my dad had a garage, he was in there all the time. So again, you're kind of just left to your own devices sometimes, you know, and it gets you into trouble and breaking it. As I said, the Bolton Street Tech was right next to it, and like, we used to just break in, man. And the cops would be coming in and arresting you, bringing you home, and bringing the police to the door. You know, the father wouldn't be happy there.
Were you told that as a child? Don't bring police to this door. Don't bring shame at this gaff.
Yeah.
I brought tons of it to the gaff.
100%, man.
And horrible. I went bad about that, you know. I felt like I let my family down. Were you the same?
Yeah, I felt like, I don't know whether I felt like I let them down, but there was more fear of, like, what was going to happen. Yeah, bringing the police to the door, like, so even though I knew if I got arrested, and you'd be in the back of the police car, and the fear, please don't bring me home. Give me a hiding, do what you want, but don't bring me home, you know, because you're going to know what was going to happen, you know?
Yeah. So you must have racked up a couple of charge sheets.
Yeah, look, I racked up a few, but they were all stupid little fucking things. You know, like, I think I was too young, even for, like, remember one time that we got caught, we were scunting on lorries, that's what we used to do for fun. And there was a lorry, we were out in Palmerstown, and it was actually near Halloween, and we were letting fireworks off the back, like, holding the wrong candles and letting them off the back, me and another guy. And just the lorry was about to hit the motorway, so if it hadn't, like, it was on Palmerstown, about to hit, like, straight out, we'll end up in the country, and someone beat the lorry down, the cops came, and the girls, and, you know, I remember even in the back of the police car, it was me and another fella going back, and the copper brought him home first, and he brought him up to the gap, and the copper gets back in the car, and he turned around and says, "Jeez, I'd hate to be that young, like, his dad's at that blade killing him up there."
Oh, bollocks, and you're thinking
that. And then I found out his dad wasn't even in. They just blade and dropped him to the door and left him off. The copper was putting the blade through, and he was saying that, you know, it's like, I was doing everything to get out of him, doing everything, offering them bribes. Of, like, I had scratch cards in my pocket. And there was a few of them. I'm like, "Here, look, I'll give you this. I swear, just let me go." You know, not a hope.
No.
The
fuckers. and that was something we said to me, "Don't bring shame in the door." I mean, just fucking, it's like the ball was rolling. There was no stopping. It sounds like you were the same. Yours was heading down the. When did you start getting introduced to the harder drugs? Like, I started off taking the drinking at 12, and weed and hash and acid, and then moved on to recreational, and then I smoked heroin later on in the years. When did you start going harder with the drugs? And were you a big gargler as well?
No, drink I wasn't, more drugs. I was the 16, 17. I start taking the methadone first, we start buying it, and all of us were doing it. You know, some of us didn't get hooked on it.
Just you start buying methadone force,
well, no, sorry, well, that would have been the first hard drugs that we would have, like, obviously you're doing the smoking, the hash, the weed, the acid, that kind of stuff.
And you didn't go, like, actually buy heroin, you just started taking,
taking methadone. Yeah,
that's mental, isn't it?
Yeah, we found a guy who was willing to sell it. to sell it to kids, I suppose, back then as well, because you're only 16.
Fuck. Yeah. I've actually never, and all the people I've interviewed and spoke to, you know, people that done heroin or gear or whatever, I've never heard anyone just starting on, on the molly.
It was kind of like a little craze between friends, you know, like we, someone said, oh, this guy has this, he's selling it for this, and people that, like, you'd never in their life think will take methadone, like, were taking methadone back then, you know, and they're, like, productive members of society, never got a hold of them, you know, but there was a certain pocket of us that I got a hold of, you know, and then, like, the, I suppose, the benzo, the diazepines kind of hit the scene in the late 90s as well, the D5s and D10s, and that was just, like, wow. No, I was like, and then like obviously the heroin, and I was like, my first time doing heroin, like smoking with my friends, it was like, I felt sick, I got sick.
Me too.
But it was like, wow, like that's what it was like. It was like, everything didn't matter. You know, there was nothing, no troubles, like everything was gone. You know, and there was nothing in the world that could have affected me at that time in the world, and I didn't care about anything. You know, and that was like, and I kept on, and like, you used to hear the stories, Matt, of like people getting addicted, and like, you know, you're back then, it won't happen to me, I'm different, and blah, blah, blah. And then I remember my first night lying in bed, and I had late sweats coming on, and I was like, oh, what's this? Can't sleep. You know, what's going on? You know, mind and overactive drive, like, and it was like, wow, I'm hooked on this, you know?
Was there a moment where you thought, yeah, I've got a problem here, I'm strung out, as they say?
Yeah, like,
was that the realization that in the bed? I'm fucked. Yeah,
that was that moment. I didn't think I was fucked. I thought, like, this is real. This is like, this is what you have to be warned about. Yeah. And it's happening to you now.
And you're probably thinking, that's grand. I'll just go out and get a hit.
Yeah, because that'll take it away.
Yeah. I was lucky when I smoked it. I didn't get that. I was like, oh, sick and all. I didn't really like it because I love taking yolks and sniff and MDMA back in the day. Don't think I did much of that. But I was more the uppers, the downer. I was just, I didn't.
Well, I've often thought, I've spoke to people around this, man, as well. Like that, like there were certain drugs I used to get the opposite effect. Like if I took, let's say, ecstasy, I love to bleed in the sky. And if I took benzos to relax, I got hyper.
Did you?
Yeah, it was a weird. And I've spoke to like other recording drug addicts as well who have experienced the kind.
It's mad that you say that, because we were in the Olympic one time. Remember the Olympic ballroom?
I remember.
We were walking down a Pier Street at the time, and this bloke said he can get us purples, right? We were like, purples? And they were Rohypnols. And he got me and a pal of mine a couple of Rohypnols, the purple, whatever they were, purple hearts or something like that, And I remember, fucking to this day, I was absolutely monged on the floor. I was telling some girl I used to go out with, all sorts of things. We got back together, it was a fucking mental. Like, but I heard that my mate that was with me at the time, he was in the middle of the Olympic going mental, wrecking it. And we have to take in the same thing. So he had an opposite effect to what I had.
Crazy.
Mental, and then I heard years ago that they were the date rape drugs that they're around taking. Fuck me.
That's right.
Isn't it mental the things that we've done back in the day?
Yeah. And the situations you kind of get into by doing that, you know. And again, like that, you've no, I suppose, for me as well, I've no regard for anybody around me, you know, my mother, my father. I was the oldest in the house, my younger brothers and my younger sisters. You know, it was like everything was all about me, you know? It's kind of mad looking back on it, you know?
Yeah. And where did it, when you know you've realized that you have a serious problem, where did that lead you? Did you get further into crime, drugs?
Yeah, like obviously the progression of the drugs got worse, you know, onto the constant wanting heroin all the time. And I'm not a fan of like even methadone clinics now, because if you ask any addict on a methadone clinic, are they just taking methadone? Like, you probably just get 1%. So they do mix and chop. Obviously, it does help people as well, but they don't stop using heroin just because they get methadone, you know. Yeah, and look, I was a shy, like I'd go into town shoplifting and I was bleeding shyer, you know, I used to keep getting caught. And I remember when Debenhams only opened, you know, and it was like, you know, you hear someone that they're getting a torch and you're like, go down to that. And they said the Levi's is just inside the door. And I used to go in with a bag and just like throw a lot of them in and walk out. And I was getting away and I got too comfortable. And I got caught one day, you know. I just kept getting caught. You know, the security guard used to say, I'd see you coming in the camera, and by the time I get down the security box, down, you'd be gone. You know, and I ran uptown one day, and a guy jumped down bleeding, rugby tackled me and took me to the ground. And I kept ending up in Clover Hill because I'd miss my car date.
That's where you always end up being remand, isn't it?
Yeah, on remand. And it got, my father paid a bail, and I suppose the obsession to use drugs was more stronger than to actually go and stand in front of a judge. You know, and he'd lose his bail money and I wouldn't get bail. And I'd end up there, and it's like 2000 to 2009. I was in there like every year with a couple of stints in Mountjoy as well, you know. For stupid driving cars without tax insurance. And my father went away and he left his car, and I took the keys and I went in to collect my methadone one day, and I went for an orange light and some geezer pulled out in front of me and I wrote off his bleeding car, you know. And I ended up in prison for that as well, for none of the above, you know. And even getting into drug selling, you know, I was in and I was caught on an Operation Clean Sweep where I sold heroin to a bleeding copper, you know. And I went to court and he had the video and he had the audio, and I ended up in prison over that as well for a couple of weeks, you know. So, look, and it wasn't me. I done that, like, jeez, imagine going out and doing that. Like, you wouldn't be able to, like, live in this way of, like, trying to do something like that. So I know it was the obsession for the drug that had me out there on that, you know?
Yeah. What was prison life here? Like, what was the, you know, give us a paint a picture of that shit.
I think Clover Hill was kind of all right. It was like, look, you're getting, you get your methadone, you get your meals, you get, like, your cell or everything. Mountjoy was different, like, not that I've been for long, but you're looking at, like, I suppose the next level of criminality, and I was like, wow.
is it pretty full of deprivation? Is it hard?
It was when I was there. That's all done up now, you know. No more
slapping out.
Yeah, and piss pots in the cells, that kind of stuff. I was there and there was piss pots in the cells, you know what I mean? I was threw into a cell and I was threw onto a guy's floor, and he's stuffing the bottom of the cell door up at night, and I'm like, what are you doing that for? He said, to stop the cockroaches from coming in, and I'm sleeping on the bleeding floor, you know. It was filthy.
Did you even sleep?
Probably did. I was heavily intoxicated, so yeah. I probably did, man, you know. So.
Yeah. Fuck me, it's mental. What about violence in prison? Any violence? Were you know, because you're from the inner city, were you in the know? Do people look after you, like, or?
Yeah, no, not that as well.
You know, problem.
Clover Hill had high security. There was very rarely, and there was nets. It was the first prison to have the nets over the yard. I was one of the first couple of hundred prisoners into it because it was only open and the shift was up there. I've witnessed people getting stabbed and everything, mates, like, and how it was done was like fairly like sneaky, you know, people coming up, putting their arms around them, so other people can run up behind them, lead them, stab them and stuff, you know. But again, like that, looking back on it, and it's like, now you'd be shocked, but in there I was kind of like, oh well,
you know,
he must have deserved it, he done something.
It's amazing how we rationalise shit like that, isn't it? Like, it'd be just, oh, well, that's the game, is what the people say, you know, you live by the sword, you die by the sword and all that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Still, like, looking back now, fucking horrible, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, oh, 100%. And again, like, the fact that I even recall that, it's still in my mind, you know, that memory is still there, you know?
Yeah, what I'm picking up from, probably because you said it earlier on when we started talking, you look back now at your childhood, at that child, little Carl, great sadness?
Yeah, I done research with this girl, and I was like looking back over my life, and I come to the realisation after that it's quite sad, you know, it's quite like, and I got an experience of like high levels of empathy for myself.
Brilliant.
You know, so it was like, wow, you know.
Is there a lot of shame and guilt there for the stuff I hear you talking about, your dad, the car, and your sister and brother? You know, you didn't participate as a family member, and you know, society tells you big brothers look after things. Any guilt and shame around that?
No, but when I got probably little bouts of it here and there, because obviously I think back and how I should have been a peer to my brothers and sisters and that, but the relationship I have with them today is absolutely fabulous.
Deadly. I'm delighted to hear that.
It's unreal. Like, I can be with them and we can bounce stuff off each other. If they have anything gone wrong, they can come to me and say, look, this is happening. That wouldn't have happened like 10, 15 years ago. Because they would have been ringing other people to try and sort me out, knowing the fact they'd actually come to me.
That's fucking deadly.
Voice, you know?
What was the road to Damascus? What was the pivotal point? Like, where did you decide, you know what, it's time to make changes? Did it happen over a time, like a ship in a dock, or was it a light bulb moment?
No, I think I never knew. Like, this is the God honest truth. I never knew you could stop. That's the truth. I thought I was destined to take drugs for the rest of my life.
Yeah, me too.
I never knew anything about recovery of changing, of like nothing. Because the people I was connected to was the people on the clinics, the people that say, I'm going to come there to do a detox. And like, oh, why are you doing that? You're just going to use again, you know?
Yeah,
so, there was this guy, Barry Costello, he's a great, great guy. He come into the methadone clinics and we done a reduced to use course.
A what?
A reduced to use.
Okay.
Reduced to use course. And it was like, we done drug diaries and we wrote down what we were taking today, and it was just a simple belief of someone else in me that when I done, took less, you can do this. No, and that was a big turning point for me. I was like, someone else believes in me here, that brilliant. I can do this.
I can relate to that. That's fucking powerful. Brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
And even something as simple as just reducing your intake of drugs would warrant someone to believe you and celebrate you.
Yeah.
It's fucking deadly, isn't it?
100%.
That small little bit of light, and you let it in.
Yeah. And I opened up, and look, it was a long road. It was a long road, you know, I done that.
Where did you go from there then?
I done the reduced use and I went into a place called Soldier, down Henrietta Street. I grew up in it. I grew up in Henrietta Street and I never even knew this place was there. You know, it's like literally 200-300 meters up the road. You know, and I went in there and to be honest, looking back, I never knew I was going to stop taking drugs. I wanted just connection. I wanted to go somewhere and be listened to and be seen and something to do and to be around other people. And I was in there for like 11, 12, 14 months before I was even ready to go into detox, you know. And I had, like, you know, you still have the behaviors, you still have, like, cheating and trying to think you're fooling everyone else, and you're only bleeding fooling yourself. I was taking the Zimos and I got into trouble, and they pulled me and they done the urine, and he says, I'm gonna have to put you out. And I was like, oh, and I broke down bleeding, crying, and says, please don't, this is all I have and this is what I want to do. And you know, that moment of like, boom, you're gonna fuck everything up. And that's what I was used to. I was like, oh, I need to do something bleeding different here, you know. Thank God they kept me. And they kept me in there.
Fuck me. So it took breaking down, showing vulnerability, I'm fucking struggling, but also you had the awareness, the notice that if I go back and do the same, I'll be the same. But if I want to do, if I want new changes, I have to fucking change. And this seems to be the path.
Yeah. There was, I'll never forget the day, Matt, where I used to send emails and all to the detox center, say, look, you need to bleed and get me in here, man. I feel like I'm running out of time, and my life was kind of changing even back then. And I was standing up, and I was at the meeting a guy out of Amin Street Clinic, Kieran, and I said, Kieran, they put a few strings here at me, man. I got the friendship background then. I said, I need you to get me in here. And we met for breakfast, and I was like, we were discussing things. And I left him, and I was standing at the bus stop waiting to go home, and my phone rang, and it was Jason up in Kildare, and he said, Carl, your bed's ready, you can come in. I'm even getting emotional thinking about it now, and I broke down in the middle of the street. I broke down crying, and there's buses driving by and cars, and the tears are just bleeding, flooding out of my eyes, you know. And that was a real moment of acceptance to me that this is it. No, this is it. And I went into detox, and I was in a jogger. I was in a plain bundle, man. In a bundle. But something inside me knew that you have to give into this. You know, you have to stop, man. You know, and I even have a tattooed on my arm there. It was only through surrender that I get to experience freedom. You know, and I really believe that. And like, I've had multiple surrenders over the leading years, you know, but that was my number one. Give in to the drug, man, give in to yourself. Grow up. You know, stop acting the bollocks, man, basically.
Yeah, fuck me. Isn't it powerful that you can recognise that moment that you thought, right, this is it.
Mm.
And surrender, and we let go, we let go and let God, as they say.
Yeah,
So where did you go from there? So we you get into it, you done well with the rehab and taking it?
Yeah, I done the 6 weeks in there, I done 8 weeks in my Keltoys, more therapeutic stuff, and didn't really like it, you know. I think I was linked in with counsellors over there, and I think it was all talked out, but I needed to put a bit of action in, you know. And I went back to Soldier for 6 months, went back to fellowship, people who wanted like similar goals as me, and I'm still great friends with loads of
Did
them.
Did you do NA, AA, and all
I've
that kind
of
stuff?
I've done them all. Brilliant. I've done.
Are you actively in AA now, or?
CA. I do it with CA.
Really, you know, very good.
Just suited me.
Great.
You know,
whatever worked, isn't it?
100%, man. And then an opportunity come up to like do recovery coaching, and joined up with like the Recovery Academy of Ireland, and we marched on the way. It was my first bit of education in years upon years, man.
Going to ask that, you know, you talked about having fears or worries about, you know, your dyslexia and undiagnosed. So we're now going to be facing, and with your drug free, facing huge fears and insecurities about education, like, you know, and what's fucking more powerful is that you're doing it fucking freewheeling, you're taking drugs to support, you've no crutches.
Yeah,
it's a fucker, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%, man. Walking into a college full of like 18, 19 year olds.
Oh, you fucking was that soldier.
The hipsters and, do you know what I mean? It's like, you can feel how you're adept, you know?
I didn't even know how to send an email. The only thing I knew about computers back then when I returned to education in 2007 was I used to go down to a cafe down on Thomas Street for datingireland.com. That was it. I didn't know how to open a Word document. Didn't even know how to fucking hang out that. Oh, it was a fucking disaster. So without drugs, you're going in there. What was that like for you?
Yeah, it was very daunting. You know, I think I had people with me, like, I suppose, on the journey with me that went through college with me. So we'd, like, meet at the bus stop. We'd go and we'd go into college together. And I think the class where I'd done, like the level 7 what I'd done in UCD was like, it was all mature students, you know, but you still had to like walk onto that campus, man, sit in the cafeterias. And
where was it?
UCD.
Right, what did you study?
I studied professional development, like addiction, learning all about addiction and stuff like that. So it's something that interests me, history of drugs and a little bit of pharmacology and stuff like that as well, and research, and way out of my depth, man. But like, I done it, and that was the main thing, you know. Like, doing it yourself, that's tough, and stressful.
Yeah, oh, here's the thing, right? Did any of your inner city skills and street education be of benefit to you in college and study?
Yeah, I lived experience, it was great.
You know, your social, or your, you know, your network and pulling people, get help off him, he'll help me here, wheeling and dealing, but in education rather than illegal substances.
Yeah, and I like, even having realizations of going through college was massive for me. You know, I remember we were doing a little bit in college one day, and we were looking at deprivation and poverty and stuff like that, and realizing that I grew up in an area with high levels of deprivation and poverty. I grew up in poverty. It was like, wow, because I never thought it. Yeah. It was normal.
Yeah.
That was my norm. That's why I was like, no way.
Yeah.
No.
Like jump overs, armed robberies. I don't know many people I've seen OD, and it was a place by my ma's, a butterfly, it was called, it was this dump. I used to see men, grown men, ODing at the heroin injections, needle in the arm. That was the norm for me.
Yeah.
Guns and drugs and violence was the norm.
Yeah.
That's fucking deprivation.
Yeah.
Like, if your kids or family were involved in that, you're like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
But that was norm to our life growing up. Mad, isn't it? 100%,
man, it's shocking.
Shocking.
Yeah.
And you think, no wonder he fucking end up on the money. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's mad, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you look back at your life, do you think, how the fuck did I actually even survive?
Yeah. I think that loads of times, man. Probably throughout one day, I think that sometimes. You know.
How did I get past that shit?
Yeah.
Mental, isn't it?
Yeah. Living in hostels and fucking dorms and smell of feet and fucking hunts, taking drugs everywhere, and you taking drugs and holding, and it's like, wow.
Just like growing up in the inner city again, we experience trauma, but then we experience more trauma, the shit that we see,
yeah,
that just becomes the norm, you know, people ODing, getting robbed and robbing other people, and just more and more, it gets more complex, doesn't it, the whole fucking situation?
Yeah, if you even look at like what you have to do to get your methadone, like pissing a leg and cup in front of someone that you don't even know, like that's, It's degrading, it's demoralising, it's like, why would you do that to a human being, you know? To give them a cup of green stuff that's probably going to save a community from getting like a car window smashed or something like that, you know? Surely there has to be something different out there, different.
Has to be a better system.
Yeah, yeah.
So where did you then go from, you done the course in UCD, the rehab, or the
yeah,
addiction studies?
I done that. I'm a youth worker. I never went to college and thought, let's go be a youth worker. You know, I went to college to be an addiction facilitator, facilitate groups.
What did you have in your mind's eye, what you thought you were going to be? Just talk to other lads doing rehab or other lads going through similar situations that you can inspire them and share your experience, that kind of shit?
No, yeah, that as well. But like, facilitate the groups of where people come in and you talk to them and try and get to the bottom of their problems and solve them and stuff like that.
Okay.
But again, it was a mad coincidence, so whatever you want to call it. I done a white collar boxing event and I met a youth worker on it from the inner city, and he was recommended for my job. And the boss rang him, he was like, "Do you know anyone that'll do it?" And he said, "Well, I'm at the meeting, this fella, he's fresh out of college, he's really enthusiastic, and I think he'd be great at it, you know." And the boss rang, the boss back then, he rang me and he says, "Would you be interested in that?" And I ran into it, "Yeah, hell yeah, like, get me in there and let's go, you know." And I come over and done an interview. I started working with the young people around Dublin, eh?
And who was what was the company you started working with?
The North Community Drug and Alcohol.
Right.
So, Fergal Conley up there, gave me an opportunity, and just progressed from that as well, you know.
What was that like for going in and working with the community, working with youths, male or female? Were you working with both?
Oh, yeah, well, my target group was mainly male.
Right.
But you're dealing with the whole community. If I walked up around the North Avenue now and nearly know everybody, you know what I mean? It's how the hell's it going? And make sure I say hello to everybody. Even Troy has grown over the years as well up there. You know, we started at 8 hours, you know, a week.
Just doing 8 hours.
Just doing 8 hours. And you're doing like some, could be doing like double that.
Yeah, like just 8 hours. Like, how could you have an impact with 8 fucking hours? Like, how do you impact someone's life if you're limited to 8 hours? That's mad, isn't it?
Yeah, again, we weren't only doing 8 hours.
Yeah, I know, but how did he expect you to have an impact? How do you change someone's life? How can you help for 8 fucking hours?
Yeah, no, yeah, right. So, after a while, we did, and we done like evaluations of like, we were building relationships with these young people that they had no relationship with any service around the area. You know, they were like standing in the flats doing whatever. You know, and it was like, I remember even going in, and it was kind of natural for me to go in and just be with them and stand with them and like, and all that, you know, people be scratching their heads and like saying, "How's you?" And I'm like, "Doing what?" Like, do you know what I mean? Like, and then it's just being with them, man, you know, and getting a relationship with them and not judging them, you know, so.
It's a big piece, isn't it?
Yeah. Like, looking back and explaining the model to like multiple youth organisations around Dublin, and like, we've done it to, DePaul, I think it was one of them. We done it out in Dunleary, and we explained the model and what we do. And
what
how
is
we
the
do
model?
It.
Can you share that with me?
Do what?
Share your model. What's the model?
Oh, it's an intensive outreach and bridging model. So
what's that entail?
It's like just outreach to the, where they're at. You know, if they stand in stairwells, you go stand in stairwells with them. And what we do is it like identify the needs of the young person. So we're reacting to their needs. And the bridging part is like, we'll bridge them to the service which they need. Or if they want to deal with an addiction, we'll bring them there. If they want to deal with education, or if they want to get a job, build up their CV, we'll do like safe passes, manual handling, or walking from heights like that. Everyone's different, man. Everyone has their own like little, like in the north, it would have been like levels of addiction, and we're in like Oliver Bond, there's not that, you know, there's not that level of addiction down there with the cohort of young people we deal with.
Right.
So it's all different areas. Even though it's on your stone throw, it's like, it's different, and it's identifying that difference and identifying that need with the young person.
And I think that's so valuable, and I talk about this before, and I'm not disrespecting anyone or playing anyone's importance. Their role is less important. But the work that you do and having that lived experience and having that observational understanding of what people do and what they're up to, you know, and going and doing the bridging and getting what the needs of the person is, because you understand that.
Yeah.
You have the gun and the badge, you know, you got the college education, now you have the And that the bridging part, I think, is fantastic. Because I was talking to someone up in Solace, one a professional, and they're not from here, they're from South County Dublin or from wherever. And we're talking about the pathway getting people into therapy. It's the likes of you that sound and look like them that will bridge them in. It's hugely important, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think the approach we use, we call a hand-holding approach, where we will actually make the referral, we'll collect them, we'll bring them, support them. Brilliant. Through it all. You know, because you're full of fear.
Of course.
Doing something like that, you know.
And if you have someone like an academic, and I'm not saying maybe they're from Holt or Bray or Sogan, and they don't sound like these people, like me going to work with someone there, they may not feel safe with me, they may feel trend. But the fact that you talk and look similar to them, they go, all right, well, I think they can probably trust him.
Yeah.
And then we bring the professional in. It's working in collaboration, isn't it?
Yeah, working with the young person. And again, like, they call you a cop on or whatever, but in the early days, and I'm like, do I sound like a cop on? Come on, man. Some of them, even of that good relay, some of them call me like, you like me bleeding that, you know, if you're challenging here and there, like me die, you know. So
brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because we can be a fatherly, we can mind them like a father, you know, we're not the father, but we can provide support and some attachment for them.
And I give a big shout out to the team, because it's I think we will use people with similar experiences to engage. I think, like, once having the cognitive beliefs of these young people and thinking how they used to think, of having that in your armor, but also having the academic knowledge of going to college and learning differently, of having both of them combined.
Fantastic.
It's a massive tool.
Yeah, and I was explaining that to the lady when I was up working with Solace. I absolutely love Solace.
Mm.
The work that they do, the staff that they have there, incredible. And I was explaining, you know, by having the academic studies, but then having the lived experience like mine, is drinking, drugs, and crime, and stuff like that, I can help bridge them to that. There's a bit of trust, yeah. And then we can bring them in, because they were saying, like, you know, it's very hard to get somebody from the inner city, from the flats, go straight to a doctor, straight to a therapist. Fuck off.
Yeah, yeah.
What challenges are you facing in the area with youths at the moment? What's going on for us?
You know, it's criminality, drug dealing, antisocial behaviour, that kind of stuff, you know, and it's heavy levels of it. Again, it's going in, I suppose, with that non-judgmental, and it can be tough trying to not judge them when you're helping them. You know, we don't, as I was telling you earlier, I was out of training today around transforming hate, of, you know, looking at people's beliefs and their bias against things, and I got a lot of myself in that, of growing up, of, like, other people's beliefs of, like, racism and gender, that kind of stuff, and how that's still in me.
Oh, like, me too, yeah. We grew up in the 80s and people were very homophobic, very racist. Lots, I could think of many racial slurs I used to say and just think that was just the norm to say.
Yeah.
And I'm just, there's shame in me about that.
Yeah, and it can be... That can be challenging, you know. And it's even saying to the facilitator today, like, what she was asking, what did you take from today? And I took that, how much actually happens, you know, like, and how.
What do you mean by that? Say that.
How much, like, if you're with young people, and the racist slurs come out, or the homophobic slurs come out, it's like, how much it happens? How much it's really their norm, you know? It mightn't be mine today, but. It is some people's, you know, again, you need to be, can we challenge that, you know, can we challenge that behaviour? It's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
No, who wants to tell, like, a 19-year-old young lady who's slagging, so you can't be doing that. You know,
yeah, like, whether they're slagging black people or gays, and, like, you might as well be talking their language to them. Yeah. When that is, does it feel like that sometimes?
Yeah, yeah. And you hear all the new slang coming out and everything, but we have had talks about it, and, like, my colleague Pierce, like, he's a little black nephew, and he will, like, if he's around a young person and they do slag someone like that, he'd say, hey, look, he'll personalise it, I have a little nephew like that, you know, and, like, the young people kind of take that kind of stuff in.
Yeah.
but again, like, it's still tough, you know.
There's a huge struggle around the area, especially this area, and that's the area I know, with mental health and suicide. How do we, what's your thoughts around helping? How do we help the youths? How do we help people? What's your thinking on it?
Around with mental health and suicide, you know, it's just that young lad from Basin Man is actually his anniversary today.
Yeah.
You know, we done a good ceremony up there.
I talked at that last year. I done a talk there. Lovely. Adam Malone,
that's him, yeah. So they done a lovely video and sang songs and rapping and real emotional. No, it didn't. I've met him once or twice, I didn't really know him, but it was really emotional. His grandfather was there, his mother was there, his little kid was there, and it was like, it was great to see that community come together and support through that, you know. If you ask him what can we do, it's like providing that space. Give them that space to be kind of, to be vulnerable, to be open about what's going on, to build a relationship with them, help them, I suppose, identify their own needs. If you ask a young person what's mental health around it, they probably wouldn't be able to tell you. That's the truth. Like, we've done a wellness cafe thing, drop in up in Denora Avenue, and the conversation was, what's mental health? And they couldn't answer it. You know, it's like, oh, I don't know. No, so it's build up, I suppose, even information around that and relaying that information back to them.
Absolutely, and that's a great point. Like, education is a big one around what is actually mental health.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Worries, fears, anxieties, insecurities. These are, and when you have trouble with that, that's mental health, you know, and they're not even talked about, you know. And again, it's in the male society. If you have them problems, it's seen as a weakness. That's still there. That's still huge.
Yeah, big time.
100%. Yeah. How comfortable are you talking about your vulnerabilities?
With certain people, I'm okay.
Yeah.
We're all vulnerable, man. We all have insecurities and massive insecurities, you know. Just trying to, I suppose, not let them control your life.
Yeah.
You know, I've done a lot of work on myself. I've done a lot of work around my own internal dialogue of how I am with that. And again, it's took a lot of years to get there and to kind of get that kind of right as well, you know?
Yeah, but, you know, and I'm just listening to you in this interview, like, you've talked about emotion too, talked about, you know, the sadness for the child. You've talked about getting emotional there. So it seems like you're a beacon of honesty to these youths, and that's what we try to be. That's why I try to do this work and be transparent, that they can hopefully see themselves in me. Yeah, I fucked up, I've done crime and drugs and whatever, but now I can still talk about my insecurities, my sadness and loneliness or whatever. It's important, isn't it?
Yeah, big time. It's dropped that, I suppose, persona. And that one of the big things I always say to these young people is that I used to think I knew fucking everything, man. You know, even if someone's talking, like, I know. And the longer I've went on, you realise you don't know. Like, you don't know anything, really. You know, and even say it to them, like, you don't know everything, man. All I do, you know, okay, man.
That's hard to listen to, isn't it?
Yeah.
I know that. And I'm going, there's a young around here, and I'm always having a chat to him. I'm like, telling him, oh, yeah, but I know that. I just shrug my shoulders and go, he hasn't a fucking Scooby-Doo.
Yeah. We were talking, me, obviously Craig's at that, joining us in Pierce.
Craig the Iron O'Brien, yup, the fucking Iron O'Brien.
He's going to have a fight coming up soon.
Is he, yeah?
I think it's, yeah. It's probably his last one, he'll have to hit retirement now.
he was a cracking interview, and you know what? I've done a few interviews with people from the travelling community and working class areas, and he brought me into his gaff, into his Maz gaff, and pure inner city gaff. It was just deadly.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I was welcomed. I felt that. It was just lovely. It was a great interview.
Yeah, he's a talker, Craig. He's been talking. He burned the ears off, you know.
He was brilliant.
But what a story, man.
Is he a better talker than he is a boxer?
Probably, yeah.
Would you take a knockout, would you?
No.
Yeah, you grew up around the same way.
We grew up with his best friends with his brother.
Deadly. You know, so. A great interview, deadly.
Yeah. It's great to have Craig on board, and obviously Pierce and Christine's there flying the flag as well.
That's what it is. He working specifically with Target, and then you guys are amalgamated with Solus Project.
Solus. He's part time. He's still in college.
He's a student.
He's a student.
That's brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah.
I was delighted when I heard when I sent you a message that day, and I heard that he was with you. I was thinking, I was saying to you on the phone, what's the connection there? And then I heard he's walking with Target, and then he's going to be obviously then walking with Solus, thinking, deadly, fucking brilliant. I really think that's on Bond.
It's brilliant because the boxing background, he walk into Oliver Bond, and they're all, some of them even know him, you know. So
that's another little chew in, isn't it? Yeah. The boxing sport, you know, and especially with lads.
Yeah, so we're putting together a boxing program at the moment. Sam Craig is involved, and it's called Fighting for Change. So it's like bringing Spike Sullivan and that's coming on to it. Hopefully Eric Donovan and Paddy Hillahan.
Cracking boxers.
Trying to get like Kelly to come in and do a presentation. She hasn't got back yet. But it's about bringing like them in and talking about how boxing kind of kept them out of trouble, or how sport kept them out of trouble, and kind of like diverted them away. And you know, you'd be getting, even with Spike, like Craig was telling me, you used to have to get buses everywhere but you had to put the graft in, you know, you had to like go through that
crack
to
get
where he's at now.
Really like Spike O'Sullivan.
Yeah.
That's a incredible fucking initiative, deadly. I hope that gets off the ground.
But hopefully we're gonna start next Wednesday, so it's just once they show up, you know, so it's all
the kids.
Yeah, it's all done and dusted, so just get them in the door now, you know. So yeah. We have Craig up first and Jamin, who was working with us as well, and they're gonna share their stories with the young people first, and then hopefully like,
what other work are you doing, just to shed some light on the work you do with Tiger Solace? What else do people need to know that you're up to, and you wanna share with us?
Yeah, look, there's loads of kind of big things happening. Solace is huge, man. They've like connections all over Dublin, mate. They're connected. They do work in the prisons with Compass. They do work on the outside when the prisoners come out. And you know, we were grateful that they took us in there, you know, because the Department of Justice come in to fund us, but they said we can't fund the drugs project. And it was a real messy time of like switching. And I was like, don't want to do this, you know, I'm comfortable where I am. And Solace come in and took us in, you know, and it was messy, but the work going on out there at the moment is massive. You know, it's all through outreach, drop-ins, of building relationships. They do, like, from the skills all the way up, you know, and to be a part of that is great.
Yeah, no, I do. I'm super proud to have gone and done that talk, and then I went out and done a talk out in Overstown, and they do amazing work, they really do. But what really, for me, is really important, the people that are in it. You know, you have the likes of Gail. She's deadly, no, honestly, no, even when I started doing this work, she used to send me a message of support and all. Deadly, and I watched the work she's done in the community, and she went off to be a bus driver. Beep, beep. And then she's back, and you have Sean and Katie, and I don't know who else have we got. Someone made Carolyn upstairs, yeah, Pierre. Caroline, I don't really know Pierre. Doing amazing work.
Brilliant, man. Great crew down there.
Great crew, and yourself, lads. It's deadly. Mm. And that's what people want, you know. You need good people that care about the community and not just there punching numbers.
Yeah.
You know,
100%,
come here. We're running close to time. What's the one thing after doing this interview you'd like people to take away to listen to?
I don't know, man. A bit of belief or something. You know, a bit of like, if you want to do something, put a bit of action in, man, you'll be able to do it. And it's gonna be probably a long road, but it's gonna be worth it. You know, it's gonna like. Believe in yourself, you're supposed to do it, you know, or else believe in somebody, like that guy believed in me, you know, like when he believes, so believe in somebody, not only believe in yourself, but believe in somebody, you know, the amazing thing was I got to go back to that very room where he done that, and I suppose deliver that very program to my best mates, who are still calling the madness, to deliver that to them, you know. So that was amazing.
That's a powerful belief, isn't it? You know, our mind believes we're every teller. So if you tell yourself you're shit, you're shit. And we've been telling ourselves we're shit for years. I've always thought I was lazy. Someone told me I was lazy as a kid. You're lazy, you're lazy. And I believed that. But then I changed that narrative and I started telling myself, because I think it's is a Henry Ford. If you believe you can't, you're right. And if you believe you're also, you can, you're also right as well.
Yeah.
So it's about that, isn't it?
Yeah.
So there you go. A fucking deadly, deadly interview. Right, so there you go. Mr. Carl Duque.
Good man.
Oh, you're a fucking dancer. No more Doherty from Nemo. I'm like Doherty from Nemo. Usually I forget things after about 10 seconds, but I got that right. Look, guys, Carl Targa, Solace Project in the Liberties, Dublin, are doing amazing work. Please support them. Check them out. Do you want people to follow you on Instagram or Targa? Do you want to share that with them?
Yeah, we're on Instagram, people. Want to give a follow. It's Troy. It's Targa Response with Youth. Give a follow. You can catch up on a bit of stuff I'm doing there.
Yeah, and Solace Project doing amazing work in the Liberties. So thank you all to Sean, Gail, Cathy, all the crew there. You are absolutely incredible. If anything in this interview triggered you, you know, whether it be the stuff we talked about, trauma, drugs, if you're struggling anyway, please reach out to someone, talk, you know, send me a message, send Carl a message, all us, speak to somebody, you know. We have got different stories, but feelings and emotions the same. So this may trigger something, this may bring back memories that you may have had a difficult past. Please don't keep that to yourself. It's important to talk. There's loads of support out there. The first and hardest thing to do is to raise the white flag and ask for help. So please, please do that. All the interviews, all the work that I do is sponsored by my old pal, Noel Riley from Rooney Media Graphics. Thanks very much. Shannon's Hope Line doing amazing work in the Liberties Grassroots, Mental Health for Kids. And Fran from the Liberty Soup Run. And if any more time, please come on down to the Liberty Market. Ah, this is where I got your name. I forgot to mention Sean and Margaret. Sean and Mark from the Liberty Market, they said to me when I started back there last year in October, you should interview Carl, he'd be good for the podcast, and I kept it in my mind.
Yeah.
And eventually it came about, but two lovely, lovely people. They really looked after me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you hear about, you know, you go into new places and the people are a bit, you know, toxic and talk about where. Lovely.
Yeah.
Like, I remember being up in the wholesalers and walking around, I bumped into him. And we sell kind of similar stuff, and he had stuff in his trolley and goes, I was only thinking about you. I think you might be able to sell them in your stall. And I just think, fucking incredible.
Deadly.
Like, lovely, lovely man, lovely woman, Margaret Chan. Thanks very much. So anyway, if you have any time, come out to the Liberty Market Thursday, Friday and Saturday. Lots of bargains and bands. People think it's closed down. It's not. We're running. It's live. We're active. I'm active, bro. So come on down. That's a saying in the inner city here. Yeah, I'm active, bro.
Yeah, big time, yeah.
I'm active. Well, we're not active. We're active talkers.
Yeah.
thanks very much for listening to the podcast or watching the podcast. Please share it with family and friends. Give us your support. And that's it. That's the crack, Carl. Thanks a lot, pal. I really appreciate your time. Yeah. Thanks a lot. Have a fantastic day. Mind your little self. Oh, 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 oh